Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello and welcome along to the show. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the program bringing you conversations that matter every week. Unbelievable. And a really interesting one today on when leaders fall. And I'll introduce my two guests in a very short moment. But if you want more from the show, the podcast, the social media, books as well, signed copies available for Christmas. And if you want the newsletter, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Now, we're going to be celebrating our 15th birthday in December, and to mark that, on the weekend of the 11th of December, we're going to be announcing the winners of a prize draw that we're running between now and then, giving away 5 apologetics books from my own library, in fact, along with signed copies of my own book to go with them. We'll also throw in an Unbelievable Conference DVD. So if you'd like to be in for the prize draw for that draw to celebrate our 15th anniversary in a couple of weeks' time, do just get yourself subscribed, okay? If you're subscribed to our newsletter, you will be automatically entered, okay? premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can sign up there for the newsletter. If you're listening from the US, we'd love you to do it at our US-centered website, unbelievable.show. You've got an absolutely equal chance of being drawn wherever you sign up from. So the links are with today's podcast. If you're listening on podcasts, head over to the website if you can. Also, it's Giving Tuesday, this Tuesday, the 1st of December. Now, this is a day that's been instituted as a response, if you like, to the commercial fever that surrounds Black Friday following Thanksgiving. Well, now, countries around the world institute and celebrate Giving Tuesday by encouraging giving to charities. If you'd like to support Unbelievable this Giving Tuesday, we would be most grateful. We are a program that depends on your generosity. A little later on, you'll hear how you can do that in a tax-efficient way from the USA at unbelievable.show, or indeed, you can do it at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to click on give. Again, links are with the podcast from today's show if you'd like more info. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent additions to the program a little later on in the show as well. For now, let's dive into today's debate.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today on the show, we're asking, what do we do? How do we respond in terms of the recent high-profile scandals that have come out among certain church leaders and ministries? What do we do when leaders fall? In recent years, a number of high-profile Christian leaders have stepped down from ministry, or their legacy has certainly been tainted posthumously by allegations of sexual impropriety. In the last year alone, it was revealed that Jean Vanier, the late founder of L'Arche, had abused his position to develop sexual relationships with women in his community. There were allegations of sexual immorality that emerged around the late Ravi Zacharias, who died in May this year. And over the summer, Jerry Falwell Jr., then president of Liberty University in Virginia, was embroiled in allegations of inappropriate behavior. And most recently, Carl Lentz, who led Hillsong New York and acted as a pastor to various celebrities, was fired by Hillsong following revelations of unfaithfulness. Well, there are more we could mention going further back, but the picture isn't great, is it? And perhaps the most pertinent of those I've mentioned to this show, at least, is the late apologist Ravi Zacharias. In October, RZIM released a statement which read, having read recently reported allegations against the late Ravi Zacharias, we're shocked and deeply distressed by them. While these allegations are not consistent with the man many have known for decades, we take any allegations of this nature extremely seriously. We're committed to an independent investigation. Well, today on the show, we're not going to be attempting to dissect the details of these cases, which, as mentioned, are still being investigated in the case of Arzim. However, the details are covered well elsewhere. We'll make sure we link to those. But in today's show, I'm joined by Karen Swallow Pryor, Professor of English and Christianity and Culture at Southeastern Seminary, and author of On Reading Well. Now, Karen was formerly on staff at Liberty University, but resigned her position following concerns about its leadership under Jerry Falwell Jr. Well, in the summer, following his resignation, she wrote an article titled Let Liberty University Be a Lesson in Unchecked Power. My other guest is R.C. Sproul Jr., son of the famed Bible teacher R.C. Sproul, but who has himself been open about his own moral failures in recent years, including being listed on the Ashley Madison website leak in 2015 and being arrested for drunk driving in 2016. In fact, that's the experience with which he begins his most recent book, Growing Up with R.C., Truths I Learned About Grace, Redemption and the Holiness of God. Well, we're going to be hearing the stories and we'll be asking, has something gone wrong when it comes to keeping Christian leaders accountable, given these latest stories? What drives successful leaders to imperil their ministry in this way? Is restoration possible? And what about the victims in these cases as well? So serious subject, but thank you, RC and Karen, for joining me on the show today. It's great to have you both. I'll start off with yourself, Karen. Before we find out a bit about you, tell us a little bit about how you reacted when you heard about some of these stories coming out, particularly, I suppose, most recently, the Carl Lentz story. What's your reaction when you hear another well-known person in ministry suddenly, obviously reputation-tainted ministry, obviously affected by that?
Well, having grown up in the church, of course, I have heard these stories now for decades, and it wasn't until this past year when I had sort of a front row seat, being part of an institution that was dealing with these things. So when I heard, the latest story, again, my thoughts, because of my newfound knowledge and close-up view of this, my thoughts turned immediately to the institutional structures that allow these sorts of things to happen and the systems in place that fail to provide the accountability that's necessary in an institution. And I know that that these kinds of sins that happen among leaders are obviously individual sins, but they also don't happen in a vacuum. And so these are the questions that we really, as a church and as parachurch and institutions and as ministries have to be asking is, because we are our brother's keeper. And so as much as is possible, we need to be holding one another accountable. And every time one of these stories comes out, then my first question is not about the sinful fallen nature that we all have, but the lack of an institutional structure that provides the accountability we all need.
I'll come to you obviously shortly for your history and at Liberty University and what's transpired there over the summer. Welcome along to the show as well, RC. We'll get your story in a moment as well. But I guess when you hear of such allegations or, people owning up to certain misdemeanors and moral failures, what's your reaction to that? How does, I guess, is that for you sort of almost expected in the way that I'm getting from Karen that she's not necessarily that surprised to see this happening?
Yeah, I would agree with that perspective. It shouldn't surprise us at all, not only because of our recent experience, but because of the experiences that we've been through throughout church history and because of the witness of Scripture. I really appreciate what Karen said about acknowledging that we're dealing with individual sins. And I appreciate also the idea that there may be institutional issues also that play a part. But I would say we need to start with that reality that we're dealing with sinners here. And I would say that some level of the shock and dismay is really grounded in a kind of thin Christianity, where we look at Jesus as a helper to sort of get us over the hump, where we know we're not quite perfect. We know the Father is very particular, and Jesus sort of almost helps us pass the test on a curve, when the reality is we're rebellious. And even when we're indwelt by the Holy Spirit, we can expect to still have genuine struggles and battles with real sins. And so, you know, earlier today, I did a podcast with a young man on the importance of vulnerability. And there were two parts to that. One, the necessity of a church that isn't shocked and doesn't fall over when someone steps up and says, yeah, I've struggled with this. But also the courage of the person themselves to be able to come forward. You know, we have a gospel that covers our sins, but it covers the sins that we uncover, that we confess. And so I want to suggest a key part of moving forward is increasing our capacity to confess.
Yeah. Well, I'll come back to you in a moment, Arcee, for more of your own story. Karen, do you want to sort of take us through sort of some of that article you wrote in the summer? And firstly, what were some of the issues that led you to move on from your position as was at Liberty University and then the subsequent resignation of Jerry Falwell Jr.? I'm guessing did you see that coming? Did you think that was, again, somewhat inevitable in the scheme of things?
There's a long story and it hasn't all come out yet, but part of the story is simply that students knew for a long, long time what was going on, and the students who knew did not feel that if they said anything that the powers that be would care. And that is what really breaks my heart. And that is why I wrote this article, and I continue to speak about these institutional power structures. Because again, we, you know, as Christians, we don't have to even be very mature Christians to understand sin nature and to understand individual sin. That is not shocking, hopefully, to any of us. But I think when we the levels that it takes for an institution to turn a blind eye or to cover up or to excuse these kinds of sins, that is what should shock us. Because again, as I said before, we are our brother's keeper and, you know, we are accountable to one another. And so, some of these stories had been circulating for a while, and more people came forward. And the stories actually began over a year ago when a report came out about the abuse of power and the way that the president was abusing, verbally abusing students and parents and other workers. And so all of us in the institution knew about this kind of leadership. And that's why even the fact that Jerry Falwell has resigned doesn't come close to solving the problem, because an institutional leader does not act alone for so long. He is supported and enabled by an entire structure that is toxic and abusive, and it all has to be rooted out in order for the institution to be healthy. That's what I hope for Liberty University. That's the process that hopefully is underway. Of course, it will take time, but it's going to take a lot of intentionality and a lot of work for that to take place.
Again, I'll come back to you for just as we delve into this more, because I'd be fascinated to hear whether you think that sort of atmosphere, which you wouldn't think on the surface of it should exist in a Christian institution, whether it's actually more widespread than we may think, perhaps. But Arcee, you've come on and thank you for doing this to share very honestly some of your story. I know that I'm not the first person you've told this to, but I'm sure every time you tell it, it involves a certain degree of humility to sort of talk about what happened. Because obviously you come from a very well-known, you know, preaching line in a sense. Your father was Arcee Sproul. And in a sense that put you in the spotlight, I'm sure, from an early point in your own ministry. And obviously it's those who are in the spotlight who are often, you know, are the ones that are examined most closely. Now, could you take us back to sort of what these incidents were and what happened and what the fallout was for you and the kind of ministry you were involved in at that time?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. When I was teaching at Reformation Bible College. I was a teaching fellow with Ligonier Ministries, and sometime in 2014, I had visited the Ashley Madison website. I was there not looking to start a relationship. I was a widow at that time, or widower rather, but I was looking for unhealthy things to fuel my imagination. And ended up that when that those email addresses and whatnot came out, mine was there among them, and found out a year later, and went through a year's suspension of my work at Ligonier, and which was a board decision, and also with respect to my presbytery. And I want to mention this before I, well, I'll go ahead and get to the latter thing. So this happened, the event happened in 2014. The release of the information came out in 2015. In 2016, I was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol. I had my two younger sons in the car, and I was guilty, no question about it. And that led to me losing my job at Reformation Bible College and losing my work with Ligonier, and one more strike against me, making me essentially a pariah in the world that I used to be able to speak into some degree. Now, for me, one of the blessings that I had was accountability. I was, and I had men of integrity who were serving as elders in the presbytery that suspended me with the Ashley Madison, men of integrity on the board of Ligonier. Before the OWI, I had stepped down as a pastor, so I wasn't a part of the presbytery anymore, but I was still a member of a church. In all of these instances, wherever there was someone in authority over me, I went and confessed my sin and submitted myself to the authority of those people. But what happens in a social media age, that what's been my experience is there's all this unofficial relationship where people, if I'm teaching via a podcast, I'm not a pastor. I don't have the authority of a pastor, but I am teaching, and I do have people learning. And then I have people who want to reduce that audience and other people that want to grow that audience. And out of that comes this twisted thing where what we call accountability is you have to stay in your sin the rest of your life. I have people on the internet all over the place talking about my lack of repentance, who are not members of my presbytery, who are not members of my session, who are not members of my family, who are not members of my board of directors, but who, I don't know, read my blog or listened to my podcast. And the whole glory of the gospel is not that it excuses what I did. That's terrible what I did, but it is covered and I'm forgiven. Now, again, I'm not arguing about how soon I should be able to do this or how soon I should be able to do that. That's not for me to decide. But I am saying that everyone needs to not feel a sense of ownership with these celebrities by which they can say, I demand to have my own personal confession, my own personal trial, my own personal imposition of judgment, and leave it in the hands of those institutions that God has established, like a board of directors. Again, I don't know any of the facts on any of these cases, but here's the thing. The fact that we know about them is actually a good thing.
Sure. I mean, coming back to you, Karen, I don't know if you want to comment on what RC had to say there, but I suppose the difference is, I mean, I'm sure people have moral failures across the board in Christian ministry, large and small. The difference is with these cases, these are people leading very well-known public-facing ministries, and that does make a difference. Now, they're as human as anyone else, I suppose, but is there an extra factor here? Is there a kind of level of accountability that does put this on a different level in any way, in your view, Karen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if complain about the public scrutiny doesn't make sense when you're living you've chosen to live in a public life. I mean, so it's a two-sided coin. If you're going to remain in public ministry or leadership, then of course then you are subject to the public's opinions. That is just part of the package. Because forgiveness, and I'm not speaking to RC's specific situation, I don't know that much about it, but I do know that forgiveness does not automatically mean restoration to the previous position, whatever that might be. God does not guarantee that when we are forgiven, we are restored to leadership or a level of responsibility that we have not yet proven. And again, I'm not speaking to RC's situation. I'm just speaking to what I've seen over and over again, where there is confession and then restoration to a previous position is what people seem to think restoration to the Lord and to the people who have been victimized by sin. Needs to be something that's addressed.
What sort of process would you like to see take place? Because I think there is a concern sometimes that mm-hmm. that people sort of want to essentially, show a certain level of repentance, but they want to move on and get back into what they were doing successfully beforehand. And very often I think the voices of those who have been abused or victimized in some way might be forgotten in that.
That would be the first place that I would look is we need to hear that the people who have been abused and victimized. And again, I'm speaking about general situations. Their voices need to be the ones that are heard first and foremost. They need to have, there needs to be reparation for them. And I don't mean, reparations in the sense that's circulating today with a financial payoff, but whatever has been taken from them needs to be restored in whatever way it can be restored. And they need to have really the most prominent voice in the process. And so often they are completely ignored or just dismissed. Because that is upside down, the whole process is upside down.
And I suppose there is this danger, I'll come back to you in a moment, Arsi, that I'm thinking of other stories as well. There was a Bill Hybels sort of ended his ministry at Willow Creek under something of a cloud following lots of allegations around the way he had engaged with female staff and so on over the years. Now, there's obviously, I could imagine in a place, built on the character of someone like Bill Hybels, or a very charismatic leader, inevitably, to speak up if something is happening could be very difficult in that situation. And I wonder if that's part of the dynamic here, Karen, going on
The fact that we don't hear from victims once we know that they exist in one situation is why we don't hear from victims in 10 or 100 times more cases where these things have yet to be uncovered. There are just so many ways, speaking about church ministry, of course, this expands to sports and other all kinds of arenas, not just those in the church. But there are so many ways to serve the Lord that when I look at these men, and it is, 99.9% of the time men in leadership who have fallen, who've been teaching us for years and years about how to serve and love the Lord in so many ways. And yet when it comes down to it, the only way that they seem to think that they can serve the Lord is again, to get in a public platform and to be back in celebrity, then that puts the lie to all of the things that we have been taught about serving the Lord quietly and privately and humbly and not necessarily having our deeds all known before the world. It's a real test of what we really do believe about servanthood in the kingdom.
Have you received criticism for, as you said, wanting to go back into forms of public ministry yourself, RC?
I have, but I haven't given it much weight because the things that I have been doing are things that anybody can do. I had internet critics jumping up and down because I had been invited to speak at a very small event, a very small local event on for actually a local drug rehab center for a fundraiser for them. And my hosts made the mistake of listing me as Reverend R.C. Sproul Jr., which I wasn't. And, it's not something that you have to be ordained to do to speak into that particular issue. I've spoken at pro-life events and had the same kind of pushback. And again, the same perspective. If I'm writing a blog and publishing a podcast, and there are a million other people doing the same thing who are also not ordained and not in ministry as such, then I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And in fact, I think it is part of serving humbly. You know, right now I teach philosophy at a community college as an adjunct professor. I am trying to make manifest the glory of Christ in that setting. But it's not glamorous at all. It's not a high platform by any stretch of the imagination, but it is an opportunity to serve, and it is an opportunity to use what I've given. The same thing with writing. If I'm writing my story or writing a story, that's not me trying to climb up onto a platform. It's me trying to tell a story about the grace of God. You know, and I want to push back just a smidge. In principle, I'm agreeing with everything that we've said so far, but I cling to, without wanting to become a celebrity and recognizing service and humility, but I cling to the words that Jesus gave to Peter. When you return, strengthen the brethren. When you return, strengthen the brethren. That doesn't mean Peter decides when he returns. It doesn't mean Peter is going to be a rock star, but it does mean he gets to speak into the lives of others about what he has learned in having had very grievous public post-conversion sin.
And is not required to constantly atone.
Right.
I suppose. There's a point at which you believe a person has to be able to say, that is in the past.
Yes.
And I believe God is calling me to minister again in such and such a context. Now, we'll come back to you, Karen, because I'd be interested in hearing where you think that balance lies, because obviously there have been a number of leaders who have apparently very quickly gone back into very similar forms of leadership in a quote-unquote restoration process, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. But we're talking today, really interesting topic, important topic, on when leaders fall. There have been a number of high profile cases of scandals, moral failures among church leaders and ministries just over the last year, really. And so I'm talking on the show today with Karen Swallow Pryor and R.C. Sproul Jr. Do hope you can join me for part two.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to Unbelievable. We're talking about when leaders fall. There have been a number of high profile cases of Christian leaders and those in ministry either while serving or posthumously being tainted because of revelations, allegations of scandal, very often of a sexual nature. Now, on the programme today, I'm joined by Karen Swallow Pryor, who herself left Liberty University following concerns about its leadership by Jerry Falwell Jr. Well, following his resignation earlier this year, which was, well, a number of issues, including issues around of a sexual nature. She wrote an article titled "Let Liberty University Be a Lesson in Unchecked Power." R.C. Sproul Jr. knows a bit about moral failures. He's been very open about his own, especially in his most recent book, Growing Up With R.C., his famous father, Truths I Learned About Grace, Redemption and the Holiness of God. Just before we go back, Karen, you've become quite well known on Christian Twitter, haven't you, in recent years? No longer just
a pretty low bar.
Well, hey, it's the only bar we've got sometimes. But yeah, there is that whole thing of Christian celebrity that doesn't exist in quite the same way it did at one time. I mean, what just let's start with your own Twitter handle, which I understand you quite appreciated. You were just saying in the break there, RC, that you like the choice of, can you just tell us what it is, RC, Karen's Twitter?
Yes. Yeah, she goes by the notorious KSP, which I don't know how much hip hop has crossed over the pond to England.
Enough to know that it's a reference to the notorious B.I.G.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. That's, yeah. So what prompted that particular Twitter handle, Karen?
Well, some of my friends on Twitter came up with that as in response to the continual trolling that I get on Twitter from my own internet critics. RC has mentioned his, and that is part of the nature of Twitter, is the kind of criticism and trolling that goes on there. And so it was a joke, and it went on long enough that and someone made a meme, and so eventually I just adopted it.
Is the trolling because, I mean, you yourself are fairly conservative theologically, Karen, yes. In terms of sort of the tribe that you swim with. But is it simply that you are a woman with opinions, a Christian woman with opinions on Twitter? What is it that you're saying that's getting the trolls agitated?
Yes, I think that's part of it, but I think it's also... It's complicated, but I would just say that because I am theologically conservative, but also critique some of those things within the traditions of my tribe, that it's easy for some people to misunderstand me. I grant them that. And it's also easy for people with ill motives to misrepresent me. And so that happens a great deal as well. And I guess that I just, I don't let it knock me down. And that's what makes me notorious. And I see Twitter, I see social media as a mission field. And there's a lot of destructiveness that happens there, but that's also why it's more extremely important, I think, for believers to be there to model how to engage with our critics, with goodwill and sometimes with humor and sometimes with, putting them in their place when necessary. But there's so much that we can and should do in this very public space that is forming our whole culture right now.
But there's also this great danger, this double-edged sword, as you say, which is that you can, it means that we're all the more aware when a significant quote-unquote celebrity pastor like a Carl Lentz has a fall from grace. And I can imagine how, all the good work perhaps that has come from someone like him engaging, popular culture, he's pastor to Justin Bieber, all the rest of it, suddenly can look... can potentially look it doesn't reflect well when suddenly these sorts of things come out, and the potential, I suppose, for a lifetime's work often of ministry to almost be swept away because of that, there is that sort of issue that comes with being on that kind of pedestal, that kind of well-known celebrity pedestal, isn't there, Karen? But people are still human, so what's the solution? Because is it that we should not have the pedestals? Is it that if you're on a pedestal, you just have to be really careful? What can you do about it, I suppose?
Well, again, we should not be on pedestals, which I guess is impossible to say in a culture where we do have, authors and speakers and Twitter. But again, we have to have the accountability built in. We are not just individuals. We are members of a body. And so even Twitter can provide some accountability. I mean, I actually take to heart and listen to all of my critics, even badly intended ones. And I think that we should take them into consideration because they have something to teach us. And so it hurts sometimes and it's wrong. I mean, sometimes, there are people who slander and lie, but we can still learn how to get cut through that and how to present ourselves in a way that the rest of the world knows that that's a slander and a lie. I mean, by our fruit that we will be known. And I think I just want to take a tiny bit of issue with what RC said before about how, you don't determine when you come back or when you step back into leadership. I think that we all do to some extent. I mean, yes, God can lead and guide us, but we make that ultimate decision. And when we make that decision, there will be people who don't understand and know us, as you said, but the proof is in the pudding, right? And the proof is in the fruit that we bear. And so my when I'm accused and slandered and misrepresented, I just know that my life is my testimony, and it will bear out what is a lie and what is the truth. And so I trust the Lord with that. And, you know, and all I can do is what I'm called to do.
I suppose you're experiencing that fact that a public moral failure, RC, will follow people, you know, for the rest their lives potentially, and make it very difficult very often to do ministry, even on a relatively modest scale. You know, some might say, well, that's the price you pay for fame. Now, in a sense, it was obviously your father who, if you like, was somewhat responsible for the level of awareness people had of your own ministry. Mm-hmm. I suppose, do you feel like there is a way back for people? Is there, or you know, once a leader perhaps at the top of their game has fallen, do we sort of have to almost write off the good that they did do in that ministry?
Yeah, I would most assuredly say absolutely not. But I understand why all the pieces are there, but I want you to see what happens when we line these pieces up. Okay. You're a Christian celebrity. You've brought shame on the gospel. We want you to disappear because you brought public shame on the gospel, and we want you to do good works where no one can see them. And when we see them, we'll let you know when you can come back.
Right. There's a
little problem right there at the end. Yeah, sure. You can't see what people are doing. That's why I'm talking about the importance of letting the judgment on issues of repentance fall in the hands of the people who actually have it. And that's not the public. Now, that doesn't mean the public has to welcome you back. That's fine. I'm not saying that anybody has an obligation to listen to me. What I am saying is that the people who decide, it's not me. The people who decide what kind of public ministry I'm ordained to do are the people who ordain, the people who are in authority over you in the local body. I never want to be in a place where, you know, I go into the closet and lay hands on my head and come out a bishop. Just not the right thing to do. At the same time, I don't want to go out and have a worldwide vote and let everybody, you know, have their say about whether or not I can do this or whether or not I can do that. So there's difficulty. And I also want to say, going back to the positives of these things being exposed, I agree that we have a real temptation. And ironically, I think you see it in smaller situations, but the danger is, we know this person has done this bad thing. But if we lose this person, our whole organization is so tied to this person. If we lose this person, we lose the organization. Now, I'm seeing that happen in churches with, you know, 500 members to 15,000 members, where that's where the sin happened. It came out, and the people in leadership are looking at it from a business perspective. How do we save the business? And maybe what we do, we can grab a hold of this wonderful gospel-y stuff, paper over the guy's sins, and put him back in there because he's the one who's putting backsides in seats, and we'll keep going. That absolutely happens, and that should frustrate us. And I'm, you know, again, I will march side by side with Karen against that. You know, I think you've got a Exhibit A in Jimmy Swaggart. But I don't want to be so on our guard against that we take a position that where we're doubtful of the power of the Spirit to convict somebody and to bring them to genuine repentance.
Coming back to you, Karen, on that point, I suppose RC feels that he is at least in a a level of accountability. He's under the authority of others who, and so he's not making the decision himself that now he's ready to go back to ministry. It's because they believe they're being guided by the council and obviously the discernment of the Holy Spirit in that process. I suppose the danger is, as he says, for where ministries are essentially have been formed around a very charismatic person at the top. And that's often the issue, isn't it, in these kinds of scenarios?
Yeah, this brings us back to what we opened on in the essay that I wrote about power. There's so much about power here. And of course, that translates into dollars and cents, as RC mentioned, and whether, you know, a ministry stays open and thrives or doesn't survive. And so it gets really complicated because it's not just it's part of the modern world we live in. We have our own church congregations and denominations that confer authority on us, but then we also have, you know, the celebrity culture. So the people who also decide whether you come to speak, RC, or I come to speak, also make those decisions. It could be a different organization or denomination, and they invite us to speak. And so there really is a great deal of caveat emptor that is required of us. I mean, we are, well, I don't know about you, Justin, but RC and I are Protestants, capital P Protestants, and there's a reason for that. But the flip, you know, the disadvantage is that we don't have a pope, you know, putting his stamp of approval on us or on our congregations or on our ministries. And so, again, we as believers or you know, people who are part of organizations, inviting people, listening to people, endorsing people, we have to be extremely careful because we are giving some sort of authority and endorsement to that person. But part of it comes down to the pedestal thing. I if you've read any of my work, you know that I believe in reading widely, reading promiscuously. I borrow the language from John Milton, being exposed to all kinds of people and ideas, which is not an endorsement. It's not agreement. But in our world, for many reasons, we tend to think that if we buy a book or we go to a conference, we're putting that person up on a pedestal, because I think we're just all looking for power and celebrity and authority. And so we confer too much of that on people by implication, maybe without even thinking about
it. But that is the way the evangelical subculture sort of exists, especially in the USA, if you don't mind me saying, Karen, that is the model. It's like,
build
this person up,
yes,
build their ministry up, and then the book sales come in and everything else. And it's very hard almost, I think, to exist in that culture and swim against that, because it's the way it's designed, right? So it's a tough one. I mean, at one level, I mean, one question I had is, which you referenced earlier, Karen, and I'd be interested in both your perspectives on this, but yes, it is 99% male. It's all men that these stories tend to revolve around. Now, I had a theory. This was back when I think the Ted Haggard scandal broke. And this is going back probably a good 10 years or so now. I can't remember exactly, but one person said, the thing is that the people who build these kinds of ministries tend to be dynamic risk takers. That's the kind of men who lead these ministries. But that has its flip side, which is that they will take risks in other areas of their life. And so it emerges very often the people who build the tallest fall the hardest, because they're obviously doing things that on the face of it, I can't understand. Why would that person even go there? Why would they do that? But I'm not that person. I'm not at the top of some, you know, super big ministry because I'm not that type of character. And I don't know, RC, this may not particularly apply to your case, but when you do hear of others who have apparently decided to make incredibly foolish, you know, decisions on a moral front, is there something to do with the kind of personality that is also actually the type that then goes and builds amazingly large and successful ministries alongside it?
I think it's possible and part of it, but I would at least want to posit something that's equally plausible. And it's this, it's not necessarily the adrenaline junkie risk-taking thing so much as it may be. And this goes again to American evangelicalism and the day that we live in, that people who tend to, think in terms of branding are people who are going to be fundamentally dishonest. That their whole thing is image. And so they project this image that creates the success, but inside there's nobody home. There's nothing there. And ironically, not that I want to in any way diminish the seriousness of the sin, but a lot of times when you're projecting that way, you're sort of like drinking salt water, trying to get your thirst taken care of, because you want to be loved, but you know that the thing that's being loved is the image and not you. And that can make you susceptible for illicit relationships. So there's a whole lot of, you know, I got all this faux love out of my platform, but it's really for a faux me. And where am I going to get real love for real me? And again, maybe that's where the breaks that someone else might have, but the risk taker doesn't, pushes them over that ledge.
Well, have you got any theories on why people do this, Karen?
I think that's very insightful, what RC just said. And I think, another aspect of that is just, and this is human. It's not, you know, it's not anything unique about our time and culture, but I think it's exacerbated by our times. And it complements what RC just said. It's so easy to compartmentalize our lives today. And that's, you know, that's one example, the brand me versus the real me. But even just, just to have, you know, have a secret private life, as we've seen in many of these moral failures, and then the public life, and then of course Satan can have a heyday with those things. But again, this goes, I just because I am this person, because I consider myself to be, even though I know people might see me as a leader, because I see myself as really just kind of part of a big machine, whether it's, you know, at Liberty or in a church setting, I'm one of the people, I'm one of the lay people. And I see more and more my own responsibility to do what I can to hold people accountable, whether it's to go to them directly with a concern to see it addressed, or whether it's to ask questions. And sometimes now I'm doing that on Twitter, or whether it's, just to question, to reach out to directly. I do a lot of that. And so many of us are afraid to do that. And we're afraid because we might lose something. We might lose approval. We might lose, you know, an endorsement. There just seems to be so much at stake in this sort of complicated machinery that we're all part of. But each one of us is so responsible to speak up, to ask a question, to heed the red flags. It's so easy for us to just rationalize, just dismiss something that looks odd or off to us. And we need to all of us, every single one of us, we have much more power collectively, I think, to ask questions, to hold people accountable, and to make sure that these people on pedestals, aren't there to begin with. And if they are, to bring them back into the fold.
Do you feel like the model can change in that sense? And will it help to protect people, ultimately, leaders and indeed potentially victims, RC?
Well, I think it could. I think it takes a whole lot of sanctification on a whole lot of people, including the audience, not just the speaker. You know, as I was listening to Karen, I was thinking about what may have been the biggest scandal of the last 10 years, at least in American Protestant reformed homeschooling world, that involved one of my closest personal friends. And we talk about accountability, and what Karen was talking about was those sort of red flags. And I look back and think, I had absolutely no idea.
And absolutely. Who was this person, just for those who don't know, if you don't mind?
I'm speaking about Doug Phillips.
Right. Okay.
I knew the other woman. I knew Doug's wife very well, and his kids, you know, very, very close personal relationship, lots of time spent together, and I did not have a clue. Now, one of the things that really endeared my wife to me when we were just starting out to date, she said something to me. She said, RC, you're depressed. And she didn't mean like today. She meant like in general. And I said to her, none of my friends who have known me for decades have ever said that. And yet you're absolutely right. So I would go a step further. Not only should we all be on our guard and alert, but one, first of all, accountability between husband and wife is critical. You know, we've got all this movement and parachurch accountability groups and men's groups, and we're going out in the woods and we're beating our drums and becoming whatever, when none of that's in the Bible. What's in the Bible is husbands and wives being one.
And even in the less high profile ministries, I know that for those who are at the top of the chain, if you like, the pastor, whoever, it can be quite a lonely place. And they may not have those people who they need to hear from and who need to speak into their lives in very honest ways, because it's almost as though there's no one around them at their level who can do that. I mean, Karen, do you experience this? Have you seen this happening when it comes to kind of people being honest, I suppose, being held accountable for what they're doing? And why isn't it happening? I suppose why can people pull the wool over so many people's eyes, you know, for so long, as we often see in these cases?
Yeah, I mean, I having that kind of accountability and those kinds of friendships and relationships is something you have to work at. You know, it doesn't happen naturally. And so any leader who doesn't have those, then shame on him, because you have to work at those. Even as a woman, and I guess, you know, we maybe sometimes are stereotyped as valuing friendships more. We have to work at them, and, you know, and we do. I do. And I certainly know that there are those rare cases where people completely fool people, but I don't know, maybe it's my womanly instinct. I think sometimes the red flags are there and we don't want to see them. Again, the fruit of the Spirit, and going back to repentance, you know, when we see a truly repentant, sorrowful person, sorry for what he has done or she, we know it. I mean, yes, people can fool people, but I think we know and recognize true sorrow and repentance when we see it. And we see a lot out there that isn't that at all. It's just, it excuses, it dismisses, it blames. Maybe part of that is, again, because we don't even teach this. We don't even know how to cultivate it in the church, and we need to work on that. I think what's
also difficult is obviously when someone's, well, behaviors come out after they've passed away, potentially. Now, we've seen this, and or allegations at least of this in respect of Jean
Those
Vanier.
Allegations were made before the person, the last, before he died, and they were dismissed. Many of them.
I mean, and that's part of it, isn't it? But so I suppose at what point, one question that I think hanging over all this is, take someone like, I'll give the example of Jean Vanier. You may be familiar with his ministry, L'Arche, which has established these communities for people with and without disabilities. He was a sort of a personal hero of mine. I interviewed him at the time of the Templeton Prize when he won that several years ago. And I described him in writing for a magazine that I wrote an article as a living saint, and did so again at the time of his passing away. And when about a year later, these revelations came out, which L'Arche had looked into and verified, I just felt heartbroken, because I thought, what a sad way to cast a pall over the whole of this ministry, which is such a valuable ministry. And I still believe in the ministry of what L'Arche does. And yet it's inevitably been tainted sort of permanently by the fact that the charismatic figure at the center of it, you know, it turns out was leading this double life of sorts. So Karen, do you think the good that someone has done can be separated from obviously the wreckage that can often, you know, occur because of the moral failures that happen in their ministry?
I mean, it's a complicated question. I mean, and every, you know, we're all fallen. And so every single endeavor that a human being does is going to be a mixed bag. And I think the best that we can do is learn from these things. I mean, again, it goes back to the accountability that's built in. And I know my experience is somewhat limited, but the people that I've known who have fallen, these were not surprises. But there are people around them, the people closest to them claim to be surprised. And I think sometimes there is just an unwillingness to see, whether because we're idealistic or because we have something to lose if we open our eyes and heed the red flags. So when we're looking at people's legacies, we can certainly, I mean, I deal with this all the time in my area of expertise, which is literature. Some of my favorite works of literature are written by, you know, abusers and cheaters and not very good people. And it does temper my judgment of their work and certainly their lives, but they still have something to offer us. And so we can accept and receive the gifts that they offer while not putting them and their works on pedestals.
We'll come back to you as well, Arcee, in just a moment. We're going to take another quick break. We're talking about when leaders fall here on Unbelievable. Hope you can join us again for the final part of this week's edition of the show.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. We know it's Thanksgiving weekend over in the USA, so a happy Thanksgiving to all the US listeners of Unbelievable who download us via podcast over there. I actually recently blogged at our new Pathos blog on 5 rules for better conversations this Thanksgiving. So if you'd like to check that out, it's available from the Pathos blog from Unbelievable. And don't forget, it is Giving Tuesday, which always follows Thanksgiving weekend now on Tuesday the 1st of December. If you'd like to give towards the work of Unbelievable, help us to bring more of these conversations to more people, we would be most grateful. And a little later on, you'll hear how you can do that in a tax efficient way from the US at unbelievable.show or premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and just click on give. There are links with the podcast from today's show. And don't forget also, if you get registered via the newsletter, which you'll be doing automatically by giving to the show, then we would love to put you in our prize draw for some special giveaway of apologetics books from my own apologetics library, and indeed copies of Unbelievable, the book signed by myself, and also some DVDs as well from past conferences. We've got 5 packs of those to give away for our 15th anniversary. We'll draw those from anyone who is subscribed to the newsletter. Again, links from today's show. Well, what's coming up straight after Unbelievable this afternoon, or this evening, in fact? Paul Cowley tells his dramatic story to Rachel Matthews of going from thief to prisoner to soldier to priest. Paul works today among ex-offenders. He's got an amazing story, as told in his new book, Thief, Prisoner, Soldier, Priest. So listen out for that on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. or wherever you get your podcast from. You can find The Profile from Premier. Here on Unbelievable next week, we're asking, is the God of the Old Testament a capriciously malevolent, misogynistic, sadomasochistic bully? That, of course, was the famous claim, along with plenty more negative adjectives, that Richard Dawkins famously made. Atheist Dan Barker subsequently wrote a book called God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All of Fiction, in which he claims to justify every single one of those objections against God from the Bible. Well, one person, Martin Kurt, a vicar here in the UK, recently took it upon himself to respond to every single criticism made by Barker and Dawkins in his new book, God is Good, Exploring the Character of the Biblical God. Well, next week, Dan Barker and Martin Kurt both join me to debate the God of the Bible. So look out for that at the same time next week. We've got your feedback coming up after we conclude today's discussion on when leaders fall.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Thanks for being with us on today's programme. We've been talking about when leaders fall and how should the church respond to a spate of recent high-profile scandals among church leaders and ministries. My guests today on the programme have been Karen Swallow Pryor. She's a Professor of English and Christianity and Culture at Southeastern Seminary, the author of On Reading Well. Do make sure and go and visit her website, which is linked from today's show. Also, R.C. Sproul Jr., who's been very open and honest about his own moral failings, especially in his own recent book, Growing Up with R.C. Again, I'll make sure there's a link from today's show where you can find out more about both Karen and R.C. I mean, we were talking just before we went to the break there, R.C., about whether we can still appreciate the good that comes from people's ministries, even when they may have had moral failures that sort of cast a cloud over that ministry. What's your feeling on that?
Well, as I was listening to you recount your story, it struck me that there's a connection between this and the historical battle that Augustine dealt with when we had, in his day, people fearful that somehow their baptisms didn't count because the fellow who baptized them had to recant under persecution. And that became a debate inside the church. And Augustine, as he so often does, answered it well and said, no, the efficacy of the sacrament is not dependent upon the moral state of the one administering it. And so when I think about what you described in your disappointment, I think, I don't know whether you can separate the man's good works from the man's bad works, but I do know this. You can separate the man's bad works from God's good works. That you can look at what this man did for these disabled folks as the hand of God at work. You can do the same thing with Ravi or with anybody else. It doesn't have to be. In fact, it shouldn't be about Ravi. What is good that came from RCIM is what came from the Bible, what came from the Holy Spirit. What, you know, every good and perfect gift comes from above. And so if it is good, it comes from him and it's clean. And our posture needs to be that we need to be grateful for it. We don't want to throw out any babies with any bathwater. I appreciated also what Karen said about reading, even outside the kingdom of God or any other sort of artistic endeavor. We can find blessings from God's hands. God spoke through Mozart just as much as he spoke through Bach. And the beauty is God speaking, not Mozart or Bach. And so I want us to cultivate that. And that, I think, could at least have a positive influence on our propensity for building up platforms and having celebrity culture.
Karen, we should probably finish this discussion by talking about the other side of the coin, which is the voice that is often not heard in these high profile cases, the voices of victims, those who have been abused. Now, every situation is different, but would you say by and large that even when there has been, if you like a mutuality to an affair or something like that, that there's still something going on when the person is a pastor in a position of power, that there's still a form of abuse going on, even when it might have, on the face of it, being a consensual type of situation going on?
Sure. Anytime there's a power differential of any type, whether it's, you know, a spiritual leader, exploiting that position, or, you know, a teacher or professor or college administrator, all of those are abuses of power, along with being, you know, the kind of sexual immorality that we also want to consider. And I think this entire conversation and this entire paradigm could be turned back upright, as I said before, if we gave more weight and voice to the victims and allowed them to lead the conversation. Instead of being sort of the last ones that are consulted or heard or being heeded. And there are, you know, there are levels of victims, to be sure. And I am not a victim in the sense that so many of my dear friends are. But even I feel like I've devoted 21 years of my life to an institution that turns out to be, you know, to be corrupt throughout, not, you know, not entirely throughout, but again, it's not just one leader, but a whole system in place. And I think it can be changed. But that feels like, you know, it feels like I have a voice that should be given more weight than it's being given. And then multiply that by all of the students and the parents who invested their money. And then, of course, there are victims who've suffered so much worse. And they again, just as Jesus says, the first shall be last and the meek shall inherit the earth. It is these victims who've lost so, so much who need to lead the conversation. And I think if we follow everything, it has a better chance of being made right.
Hmm. What's your feeling on that, RC? I think it's interesting to some extent that a lot of these stories have come out in the wake of the Me Too movement. And as Karen said earlier, this is not a phenomenon that's restricted by any means to the Christian church. I mean, across all sectors, there has been a reckoning, I would say, of men, especially in positions of power, not least in the film industry, obviously, Harvey Weinstein and so on. But I think a renewed realization that we need to hear from victims, and very often it's the abuser, the person in power, who then gets to dominate the narrative even after the fact. So do you welcome that, the fact that people are turning in that direction increasingly?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think one of the very same hardship that comes out of the ease with which we can build platforms on social media is the democratization of access to audience. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing. And part of the good thing is you can't spike this kind of story. You know, if William Randolph Hearst were abusing the whole secretarial pool, we would never know. If John F. Kennedy were bringing floozies into the White House, we would never know. Or at least not for a long time. And so, yes, the problem is, of course, again, is when we turn these media tools into pseudo trials. I am 100% in favor of hearing victims, but I'm also aware enough to know that there are people who say they're victims who are not. And what often happens on both sides of the aisle is if it's our guy who's being accused, we have a really high standard of what's legitimate evidence. And if it's their guy that's being accused, we have a very low standard. And that's just really, really unhealthy and part of the echo chamber danger that comes with social media.
And Karen, not everyone was in favor of that sort of hashtag of always trust women when the Me Too movement was at its height. They felt, well, hang on, there still has to be a level at which we do hear from both sides. It's just that obviously we haven't heard in the past from the women, the victims, very often in this case. So where for you is the balance to be struck on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sage advice of Ronald Reagan applies to this, you know, trust but verify. I think that, you know, our inclination should be, and ample evidence and research shows that there are very, very tiny, tiny percentage of false accusations. So our tendency should be to believe. I mean, an entire industry of psychoanalysis founded by Sigmund Freud was built on his refusal to believe the women that he was studying, that they were being raped and molested by their family members. So he developed his entire theory of the Oedipus complex and the Orestes complex because he simply refused to believe that these women were telling him things that were actually happening in their homes. And so it's a great example from history of how an entire industry was built on the premise of not believing women when they were in fact telling the truth. And we're still seeing the effects of that today.
We are drawing our time to drawing to a close. Do you feel, both of you, that Christian Witness can recover from these kinds of scandals, or do we have to significantly change the way, I suppose, we're doing ministry and the kind of forms of ministry that often predominate that do allow for these very high profile falls from grace to happen? I'll ask you first, RC.
Well, I would say this, that the what needs to happen... this whole idea out in the secular world that Christians are hypocrites in some ways is the Christian's fault. It's not because Christians sin. It's because Christians don't acknowledge that they do. If we were upfront with, hey, our faith is all about bad people who need God's forgiveness, and that's why you're welcome. If we were vulnerable and out and open that way, then when these things happen, we would be able to say, see, it's just like we told you. But when we present ourselves, maybe not in word, but in deed, when we present ourselves as model citizens who have it all together, and then lo and behold, we don't, then yeah, it's really damaging. But again, the solution, it would be a great solution if Jesus decided to sanctify us completely all at once, but it's not his plan. His plan is for us to humble ourselves and acknowledge our sin. And that's what I say needs to change.
Mm-hmm. All right, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I agree with RC there. And I think, you know, I think we have had, and I say this again as a capital P Protestant, I do think we've had kind of a 500-year accumulation of this Protestantism mixed with the modernity, and that's a whole other topic. But that's where that idea of everything being great and that superficiality comes from. And I think we might actually be in kind of a 500-year moment in the church where this error will be corrected. I won't call that a reformation, but something like that. And I think the younger generations who are kind of seeing through these errors that we've been making for all of modernity, I think something new may break through. It won't be perfect. It won't be until Jesus comes again. But I think something is happening in this moment. It's painful, mm-hmm. but I think the Lord is going to birth something good out of these painful things.
It's been so helpful having both of your perspectives on the program today. Karen Swallow Pryor and RC Sproul Jr. have been my guests on Unbelievable. Thank you both for being with me on the show today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
If you'd like to get in touch with us about today's show, then do feel free to email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Find us on social media too, @unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb to get in touch that way. You can find me on Instagram too, justin.brierley. All the links available as ever from the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thanks, by the way, to Brian on Instagram, who got in touch to say thank you for your work and perspective. I just finished listening to the episode of Unbelievable dealing with coronavirus and the church's response to it and was incredibly encouraged. It really was an answer to prayer. I live in Washington State and serve at a church which has become increasingly tied to the political rights narrative of the virus, which is now culminating in disobeying our government orders, which I believe are put in place to protect citizens, and is causing us to step away from the church for the time being. While my wife and I may be the minority within our church, to hear all of your perspectives made me feel less alone. God bless you, praying for your ministry. Thank you, Brian. I must say your message was one of a few that were more positive, in all honesty, to that program. A lot of people felt that the balance was too much on the side of caution on that particular episode. But thanks for getting in touch. Amani says, I appreciate how your show cultivates thoughtful disagreement between Christians and non-Christians. I'd love to see Alvin Plantinga on the show. He was awarded the 2017 Templeton Prize, and his contributions to apologetics are exemplified in the fact that Tim Keller's New York Times bestseller, The Reason for God, cited Plantinga offering a plausible explanation of how a good God could allow evil and suffering to happen in the world. Well, as it happens, Amani, we have had Plantinga on the show a couple of times over the years, most recently a few years ago in the wake of his winning the 2017 Templeton Prize. So do go and check that out in our archives. It was a special Q&A edition of the show we did with Plantinga in response to that. So go and check that out. Christian is in Norway, but he's not a Christian. He says, I teach religion in a Norwegian high school. But besides that, in my off hours, I'm the vice president of the Norwegian Humanist Association. I love the fact that a vice president of the Norwegian Humanist Association listens to Unbelievable. So lovely to hear from you, Christian. You say, I've been so fortunate to find your podcast during the last year, and as a concept, I find it a great addition to my weekly playlist. I've not found a similar Norwegian podcast with the same dialogue between theists and non-theists. I'd like that very much. You go on to say that as a fellow Norwegian, you want to comment on a comment that was read out recently by
Eivind Algroy, it's hardly a good description to say that the best parts of the Norwegian secular system is an inheritance from conservative Christianity. Although parts of it can trace some of its origins from conservative Christianity, much can as well trace it back to the socialist movements of the early 1900s and to the changes made within the social democratic system after the Second World War. It should be noted that Norway is quite interesting, with around half the population claiming to be atheists and humanists of different varieties. Yet still, the government and parts of the Christian population still make claims to Norway as a Christian country. Well, thank you, aptly named Christian, who sent that email in, which I suppose in itself is a little testament to the influence of Christianity in the Nordic countries. But Christian, yeah, I'd be interested in doing a discussion on this at some point. Maybe you could be someone who would, you know, take the secularist point of view on that one. Great to hear from you. Thanks for getting in touch. Intelligent design, that was our subject of last week. Thanks very much to those who tweeted. Lars said, another insightful, respectful and significant conversation. A key point of disagreement between Mike Behe and Joshua Swamidas was at which level and how can we discern God's design as creator? Only at the macrocosmos level or also at the microcosmic level? The masked Nerdvenger tweeted, listening to the recent episode on evolution intelligent design, I'd like to point something out. This was something Joshua Swamidas said. Bill Nye actually holds a master's in engineering. Now, he may not be a scientist in any sense that you'd accept, but he has a strong grasp of the scientific method and is a master science explainer. He takes complex scientific ideas and puts them in terms the laity, as it were, can easily grasp. You should probably give his productions a look-see. All right, thank you very much. Yes, this was Joshua Swamidas and Mike Behe discussing the Dover trial from 15 years ago, which put ID on the stand. And then, of course, discussing Mike's own views on irreducible complexity. Thanks for all of these emails that have come in as well. This one from Andrew says, I'm a long-standing fan of the show, but I was disappointed that you had on Michael Behe discussing his disastrous appearance as an expert witness in Kitzmiller versus Dover without having a lawyer on to correct numerous gross misrepresentation of the facts and the law, in particular Behe's central claim that the judge improperly copied the plaintiff's briefs, which is laughable, and any honest lawyer, Christian or not, would know that. Thank you very much. I'll note that you see that as not having been stating really what was going on, Andrew. Paul Rimmer, who's a researcher, science researcher out in Cambridge, says, writing to you about that recent show, it was somewhat disappointing, especially considering the calibre of the guests. One of the issues with the show is that Swamidas did not seem to take intelligent design seriously as a scientific hypothesis. Well, I don't either, but why engage the topic in a public forum if you don't take it seriously? This lack of seriousness led to a lack of genuine engagement. Swamidas often ignored questions and topics raised and instead chose to ask and then answer his own questions. Another issue is that Behe didn't seem to take intelligent design far enough in terms of his own theology. The most useful and interesting part of the show for me was the discussion about Mount Rushmore versus Mount Everest. Here Behe invoked different levels of design based on human intuition, and I find my religious belief and the intuition derived from my belief leads to the exact opposite conclusions. Mount Everest to me looks like it was designed by an infinite intelligence, and Mount Rushmore looks like it was designed in part by an infinite intelligence and then in part by a finite intelligence, using material and methods created by an infinite intelligence. Mount Everest and the natural aspects of Mount Rushmore both look to be designed at a far higher level than the carvings of faces. I think Behe's intuition and theology are completely backwards. I don't take ID seriously as a scientific project, and I'm philosophically opposed to it for core theological reasons, so I personally wouldn't engage in a debate about it. But I recommend that if Josh Swamidas is invited back, the topic be limited to the theology or philosophy of ID, not the science. Thank you very much, Paul. Good to hear from you. And we've had other responses to that show as well, but we'll leave them to one side for the moment, because I do want to get to this one. This was very interesting. You remember we did a show on conversion and deconversion with Jana Harman and Joel Furches. Both have done quite a bit of research in that area. This was from James in Swindon, who says, I started listening to your podcast about a year ago. Really enjoy the people you manage to bring together and the topics they discuss. Also appreciate the job you do moderating, which can't be the easiest thing to do. The discussion between Jana Harman and Joel Furches was of interest, especially when talking about why Christians abandon their faith. And this topic has come up a number of times, such as when Joel Steingard appeared on your show, John Steingard, that is, and including how some have reconstructed their faith sometime afterwards, but to a more progressive form of Christianity, as covered in that debate between Elisa Childers and Lisa Gunga. Well, all this has encouraged me in my goal to write a book about my experience of deconstruction and reconstruction. I was a born-again, committed Christian for 15 years until I stopped believing in my mid-30s and passionately identified as a humanist atheist for 9 years and was a member of the British Humanist Association for 1 year. However, in the summer of 2015, I came back to faith after a period of reflection and with some help from books by the Christian apologist John Lennox. Please let your listeners know that although there are stories of deconversion or deconstruction, as it's often called, sometimes involving prominent former Christians, the story doesn't necessarily have to end there. I genuinely could not see how I could possibly go back to believing in God again once it had all unraveled. And yet I did. And my faith is probably even stronger for this experience. On another, perhaps selfish note, I'd be very grateful for any advice or help in writing this book. Thanks, James. Loved to hear from you from Swindon. I'll get in touch, James. Both fascinated to hear more about your story. But if I've got any advice on writing books, I'm not sure it'd be very helpful. I'm struggling to write my own one at the moment. But we'll see what we could do. Here's just a couple more emails and then we'll have to wrap it up for today's show. This is going back to the great discussion between Julian Baggini and Sky Jatani on whether Jesus was just a great moral teacher or something more. Isso gets in touch to say, love the show, really believe you're doing God's work. I enjoyed that dialogue, but I think that Julian Baggini, your atheist, misses the messianic context in which Christ is speaking and trivializes Christ's teachings. I believe Christ's teachings are literally impossible, but that's the point. You say, I was reading the Gospel of Luke a few months ago, trying to grapple with what I do with Jesus. So I wrote an article about it to explore who he actually is. Hope you get a chance to read it. Thanks for linking me to that article, by the way, Isso. Exactly Who is Jesus, the Son of God? It's published over at the Medium website. So appreciate you sending that in. On that debate, Helen in North London said, Sky made a comment about the many Christians and Americans who support Donald Trump as being dumbed down and seeing the Bible as a tokenistic thing. I'm not convinced this explains it. I frequently come across this view, but would like to offer an alternative explanation. I'm not trying to make out Trump is a saint, but that he's no worse a sinner than the rest of us and has instigated, in fact, some godly policies in his 3 going on 4 years as a president. I'm rejecting the notion perpetuated in the media that he's a madman and anyone who supports him is deluded. And you go on to give about 12 or 14 reasons, in fact, about why you believe he's actually done a lot of good. Thank you very much, Helen. No time to read out all of those. But of course, the reality is millions and millions of people voted for him in the latest election. And even though he has lost that election, obviously still disputed by his team, it would be, you know, crazy to say that they're all deluded. And I certainly wouldn't say that either. I'm not personally in favour of Trump. You know, that may not be much of a secret on this show, but I fully understand and sympathise with my many friends in the US who have felt it necessary to vote for Trump. I can understand why some of them, many people would feel that way. Tim is another friend out in the US, hails from Florida, has been catching up on some shows recently and said he caught up with this Sky Jatani and Julian Baggini show and says it lived up to the reviews as I'd put it among my all-time favourites. Not having heard of either of the guests before, I'm now avidly looking at their material. The comment I'd like to leave is that C.S. Lewis's well-known trilemma passage that you quoted really should be updated to what could be termed a quadrilemma by adding a fourth category, also beginning with an L. Lord, liar, and lunatic are not the only options, as Baggini pointed out. As an atheist, he opts for the fourth option, legend. As one can see on many a Christmas card, certain elements of legend have obviously accrued in the intervening 2,000 years. Nevertheless, relegating the miracle stories and other supernatural aspects of the New Testament accounts to mere legend, while a convenient escape hatch for those committed to naturalistic presuppositions, is not, in my opinion, being intellectually honest. While there's obviously no way to prove that the miracles of Jesus actually happened, since they were one-time events in the distant past, there's a surprising amount of circumstantial evidence, particularly when it comes to the greatest miracle of all, the resurrection of the crucified Jesus. Many a skeptic has approached that evidence with the intent of backing up that fourth option of legend, only to become believers themselves. So while on the surface the fourth option is there for our quadrilemma, in reality it actually isn't, which puts us right back to C.S. Lewis's trilemma. Either way, though, this leads to the dilemma every person faces. Either he is or he is not who he claimed to be. C.S. Lewis had it right. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much for all of those emails across a whole range of shows we've had in the past several weeks. It's been good, hasn't it? It's been really interesting to get so much interaction and engagement. And speaking of the conversion deconversion episode, which we covered, there's a great blog by our friend Eric Strandness on our Pathos blog that's getting a lot of interest at the moment, looking at some of the lessons that you can draw from why Christians become atheists and atheists become Christians. Again, that's over at our Pathos blog. Thanks for being part of today's show. And with Giving Tuesday coming up, you can support the show as well. If you're out in the US listening via podcast, unbelievable.show is a great place to do that. And anywhere else in the world, we welcome your gifts and thank you for them at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on give. For now, thanks very much. And let me tell you what's coming up next week. Is the God of the Old Testament a capriciously malevolent, misogynistic, sadomasochistic bully? That, of course, was the famous claim alongside many other negative adjectives that Richard Dawkins gave in The God Delusion. Well, atheist Dan Barker followed it up with a book of his own in which he essentially justified or defended every single one of those objections against the God of the Bible. Recently, Martin Kurt, a vicar in the UK, has taken it upon himself to respond to all of those critiques. He'll be on the show with Dan Barker next week to debate the God of the Bible. So, thanks for being with us. See you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. We know it's Thanksgiving weekend over in the USA, so a happy Thanksgiving to all the US listeners of Unbelievable who download us via podcast over there. I actually recently blogged at our new Pathos blog on 5 rules for better conversations this Thanksgiving. So if you'd like to check that out, it's available from the Pathos blog from Unbelievable. And don't forget, it is Giving Tuesday, which always follows Thanksgiving weekend now, on Tuesday the 1st of December. If you'd like to give towards the work of Unbelievable, help us to bring more of these conversations to more people, we would be most grateful. And a little later on, you'll hear how you can do that in a tax-efficient way from the US at unbelievable.show or premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and just click on give. There are links with the podcast from today's show. And don't forget also, if you get registered via the newsletter, which you'll be doing automatically by giving to the show, then we would love to put you in our prize draw for some special giveaway of apologetics books from my own apologetics library, and indeed copies of Unbelievable, the book signed by myself, and also some DVDs as well from past conferences. We've got 5 packs of those to give away for our 15th anniversary. We'll draw those from anyone who is subscribed to the newsletter. Again, links from today's show. Well, what's coming up straight after Unbelievable this afternoon, or this evening in fact? Paul Cowley tells his dramatic story to Rachel Matthews of going from thief to prisoner, to soldier, to priest. Paul works today among ex-offenders. He's got an amazing story, as told in his new book, Thief, Prisoner, Soldier, Priest. So listen out for that on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. or wherever you get your podcast from. You can find The Profile from Premier. Here on Unbelievable next week, we're asking, is the God of the Old Testament a capriciously malevolent, misogynistic, sadomasochistic bully. That, of course, was the famous claim, along with plenty more negative adjectives that Richard Dawkins famously made. Atheist Dan Barker subsequently wrote a book called God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All of Fiction, in which he claims to justify every single one of those objections against God from the Bible. Well, one person, Martin Kurt, a vicar here in the UK, recently took it upon himself to respond to every single criticism made by Barker and Dawkins in his new book, God is Good, Exploring the Character of the Biblical God. Well, next week, Dan Barker and Martin Kurt both join me to debate the God of the Bible. So look out for that at the same time next week. We've got your feedback coming up after we conclude today's discussion on when leaders fall.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Thanks for being with us on today's programme. We've been talking about when leaders fall and how should the church respond to a spate of recent high-profile scandals among church leaders and ministries. My guests today on the programme have been Karen Swallow Pryor. She's a Professor of English and Christianity and Culture at Southeastern Seminary, the author of On Reading Well. Do make sure and go and visit her website, which is linked from today's show. Also, R.C. Sproul Jr., who's been very open and honest about his own moral failings, especially in his own recent book, Growing Up with R.C. Again, I'll make sure there's a link from today's show where you can find out more about both Karen and R.C. We were talking just before we went to the break there, R.C., about whether we can still appreciate the good that comes from people's ministries, even when they may have had moral failures that sort of cast a cloud over that ministry. What's your feeling on that?
Well, as I was listening to you recount your story, it struck me that there's a connection between this and the historical battle that Augustine dealt with when we had, in his day, people fearful that somehow their baptisms didn't count because the fellow who baptized them had to recant under persecution. And that became a debate inside the church. And Augustine, as he so often does, answered it well and said, no, the efficacy of the sacrament is not dependent upon the moral state of the one administering it. And so when I think about what you described in your disappointment, I think, I don't know whether you can separate the man's good works from the man's bad works, but I do know this. You can separate the man's bad works from God's good works. That you can look at what this man did for these disabled folks as the hand of God at work. You can do the same thing with Ravi or with anybody else. It doesn't have to be. In fact, it shouldn't be about Ravi. What is good that came from RCIM is what came from the Bible, what came from the Holy Spirit. What, you know, every good and perfect gift comes from above. And so if it is good, it comes from him and it's clean. And our posture needs to be that we need to be grateful for it. We don't want to throw out any babies without any bathwater. I appreciated also what Karen said about reading, even outside the kingdom of God or any other sort of artistic endeavor. We can find blessings from God's hands. God spoke through Mozart just as much as he spoke through Bach. And the beauty is God speaking, not Mozart or Bach. And so I want us to cultivate that. And that, I think, could at least have a positive influence on our propensity for building up platforms and having celebrity culture.
Karen, we should probably finish this discussion by talking about the other side of the coin, which is the voice that is often not heard in these high profile cases, the voices of victims, those who have been abused. Now, there is every situation is different, but would you say by and large that even when there has been, if you like, a mutuality to an affair or something like that, that there's still something going on when the person is a pastor in a position of power, that there's still a form of abuse going on, even when it might have on the face of it being a consensual type of situation going on?
Sure. Anytime there's a power differential of any type, whether it's, a spiritual leader, exploiting that position, or a teacher or professor or college administrator, all of those are abuses of power, along with being, the kind of sexual immorality that we also want to consider. And I think this entire conversation and this entire paradigm could be turned back upright, as I said before, if we gave more weight and voice to the victims and allowed them to lead the conversation. And if instead of being sort of the last ones that are consulted or heard, or getting being heeded. And there are, you know, there are levels of victims to be sure. And I am not a victim in the sense that so many of my dear friends are. But even I feel like I've devoted 21 years of my life to an institution that turns out to be, you know, to be corrupt throughout, not, you know, not entirely throughout, but again, it's not just one leader, but a whole system in place. And I think it can be changed. But that feels like, you know, it feels like I have a voice that should be given more weight than it's being given. And then multiply that by all of the students and the parents who invested their money. And then, of course, there are victims who've suffered so much worse. And they, again, just as Jesus says, the first shall be last and the meek shall inherit the earth. It is these victims who've lost so, so much who need to lead the conversation. And I think if we follow everything, it has a better chance of being made right.
Hmm. What's your feeling on that, RC? I think it's interesting to some extent that a lot of these stories have come out in the wake of the Me Too movement. And as Karen said earlier, this is not a phenomenon that's restricted by any means to the Christian church. I mean, across all sectors, there has been a reckoning, I would say, of men, especially in positions of power, not least in the film industry, obviously Harvey Weinstein and so on. But I think a renewed realization that we need to hear from victims, and very often it's the abuser, the person in power, who then gets to dominate the narrative even after the fact. So do you welcome that, the fact that people are turning in that direction increasingly?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think one of the very same hardship that comes out of the ease with which we can build platforms on social media is the democratization of access to audience. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing. And part of the good thing is you can't spike this kind of story. You know, if William Randolph Hearst were abusing the whole secretarial pool, we would never know. If John F. Kennedy were bringing floozies into the White House, we would never know, or at least not for a long time. And so, yes, the problem is, of course, again, is when we turn these media tools into pseudo trials. I am 100% in favor of hearing victims, but I'm also aware enough to know that there are people who say they're victims who are not. And what often happens on both sides of the aisle is if it's our guy who's being accused, we have a really high standard of what's legitimate evidence. And if it's their guy that's being accused, we have a very low standard. And that's just really, really unhealthy and part of the echo chamber danger that comes with social media.
And Karen, not everyone was in favor of that sort of hashtag of always trust women when the Me Too movement was at its height. They felt, well, hang on, there still has to be a level at which we do hear from both sides. It's just that obviously we haven't heard in the past from the women, the victims, very often in this case. So where for you is the balance to be struck on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sage advice of Ronald Reagan applies to this, you know, trust but verify. I think that, you know, our inclination should be, and ample evidence and research shows that there are very, very tiny, tiny percentage of false accusations. So our tendency should be to believe. I mean, an entire industry of psychoanalysis founded by Sigmund Freud was built on his refusal to believe the women that that he was studying that they were being raped and molested by their family members. So he developed his entire theory of the Oedipus complex and the Orestes complex because he simply refused to believe that these women were telling him things that were actually happening in their homes. And so it's a great example from history of how an entire industry was built on the premise of not believing women when they were in fact telling the truth. And we're still seeing the effects of that today.
We are drawing, our time is drawing to a close. Do you feel, both of you, that Christian Witness can recover from these kinds of scandals? Or do we have to significantly change the way, I suppose, we're doing ministry and the kind of forms of ministry that often predominate that do allow for these very high profile falls from grace to happen? I'll ask you first, RC.
Well, I would say this, that what needs to happen, this whole idea out in the secular world that Christians are hypocrites, in some ways is the Christian's fault. It's not because Christians sin, it's because Christians don't acknowledge that they do. If we were upfront with, hey, our faith is all about bad people who need God's forgiveness, and that's why you're welcome. If we were getting vulnerable and out and open that way, then when these things happen, we would be able to say, see, it's just like we told you. But when we present ourselves, maybe not in word, but indeed, when we present ourselves as model citizens who have it all together, and then lo and behold, we don't, then yeah, it's really damaging. But again, the solution, it would be a great solution if Jesus decided to sanctify us completely all at once, but it's not his plan. His plan is for us to humble ourselves and acknowledge our sin. And that's what I say needs to change.
Mm-hmm. All right, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I agree with RC there. And I think, you know, I think we have had, and I say this again as a capital P Protestant, I do think we've had kind of a 500-year accumulation of this Protestantism mixed with modernity, and that's a whole other topic. But that's where that idea of everything being great and that superficiality comes from. And I think we might actually be in kind of a 500-year moment in the church where this error will be corrected. I won't call that a reformation, but something like that. And I think the younger generations who are kind of seeing through these errors that we've been making for all of modernity, I think something new may break through. It won't be perfect. It won't be until Jesus comes again. But I think something is happening in this moment. It's painful, mm-hmm. but I think the Lord is going to birth something good out of these painful things.
It's been so helpful having both of your perspectives on the program today. Karen Swallow Pryor and RC Sproul Jr. have been my guests on Unbelievable. Thank you both for being with me on the show today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
If you'd like to get in touch with us about today's show, then do feel free to email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Find us on social media too, @unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb to get in touch that way. You can find me on Instagram too, justin.briley. All the links available as ever from the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thanks, by the way, to Brian on Instagram, who got in touch to say thank you for your work and perspective. I just finished listening to the episode of Unbelievable dealing with coronavirus and the church's response to it and was incredibly encouraged. It really was an answer to prayer. I live in Washington State and serve at a church which has become increasingly tied to the political rights narrative of the virus, which is now culminating in disobeying our government orders, which I believe are put in place to protect citizens, and is causing us to step away from the church for the time being. While my wife and I may be the minority within our church, to hear all of your perspectives made me feel less alone. God bless you, praying for your ministry. Thank you, Brian. I must say your message was one of a few that were more positive, in all honesty, to that program. A lot of people felt that the balance was too much on the side of caution on that particular episode. But thanks for getting in touch. Amani says, I appreciate how your show cultivates thoughtful disagreement between Christians and non-Christians. I'd love to see Alvin Plantinga on the show. He was awarded the 2017 Templeton Prize, and his contributions to apologetics are exemplified in the fact that Tim Keller's New York Times best
bestseller, The Reason for God, cited Plantinga offering a plausible explanation of how a good God could allow evil and suffering to happen in the world. Well, as it happens, Amanda, we have had Plantinga on the show a couple of times over the years, most recently a few years ago in the wake of his winning the 2017 Templeton Prize. So do go and check that out in our archives. It was a special Q&A edition of the show we did with Plantinga in response to that. So go and check that out. Christian is in Norway, but he's not a Christian. He says, I teach religion in a Norwegian high school, but besides that, in my off hours, I'm the vice president of the Norwegian Humanist Association. I love the fact that a vice president of the Norwegian Humanist Association listens to Unbelievable. So lovely to hear from you, Christian. You say, I've been so fortunate to find your podcast during the last year. And as a concept, I find it a great addition to my weekly playlist. I've not found a similar Norwegian podcast with the same dialogue between theists and non-theists. I'd like that very much. You go on to say that as a fellow Norwegian, you want to comment on a comment that was read out recently by Eivind Algroy. It's hardly a good description to say that the best parts of the Norwegian secular system is an inheritance from conservative Christianity. Although parts of it can trace some of its origins from conservative Christianity, much can as well trace it back to the socialist movements of the early 1900s and to the changes made within the social democratic system after the Second World War. It should be noted that Norway is quite interesting, with around half the population claiming to be atheists and humanists of different varieties, yet still the government and parts of the Christian population still make claims to Norway as a Christian country. Well, thank you, aptly named Christian, who sent that email in, which I suppose in itself is a little testament to the influence of Christianity in the Nordic countries. But Christian, yeah, I'd be interested in doing a discussion on this at some point. Maybe you could be someone who would, you know, take the secularist point of view on that one. Great to hear from you. Thanks for getting in touch. Intelligent design, that was our subject of last week. Thanks very much to those who tweeted. Lars said, another insightful, respectful and significant conversation. A key point of disagreement between Mike Behe and Joshua Swamidas was at which level and how can we discern God's design as creator? Only at the macrocosmos level or also at the microcosmic level? The masked Nerdvenger tweeted, listening to the recent episode on evolution intelligent design, I'd like to point something out. This was something Joshua Swamidas said. Bill Nye actually holds a master's in engineering. Now, he may not be a scientist in any sense that you'd accept, but he has a strong grasp of the scientific method and is a master science explainer. He takes complex scientific ideas and puts them in terms the laity, as it were, can easily grasp. You should probably give his productions a look-see. All right, thank you very much. Yes, this was Joshua Swamidas and Mike Behe discussing the Dover trial from 15 years ago, which put ID on the stand. And then, of course, discussing Mike's own views on irreducible complexity. Thanks for all of these emails that have come in as well. This one from Andrew says, I'm a long-standing fan of the show, but I was disappointed that you had on Michael Behe discussing his disastrous appearance as an expert witness in Kitzmiller versus Dover without having a lawyer on to correct numerous gross misrepresentation of the facts and the law, in particular Behe's central claim that the judge improperly copied the plaintiff's briefs, which is laughable, and any honest lawyer, Christian or not, would know that. Thank you very much. I'll note that you see that as not having been stating really what was going on. Andrew, Paul Rimmer, who's a researcher, science researcher out in Cambridge, says, writing to you about that recent show, it was somewhat disappointing, especially considering the caliber of the guests. One of the issues with the show is that Swamidas did not seem to take intelligent design seriously as a scientific hypothesis. Well, I don't either, but why engage the topic in a public forum if you don't take it seriously? This lack of seriousness led to a lack of genuine engagement. Swamidas often ignored questions and topics raised and instead chose to ask and then answer his own questions. Another issue is that Behe didn't seem to take intelligent design far enough in terms of his own theology. The most useful and interesting part of the show for me was the discussion about Mount Rushmore versus Mount Everest. Here, Behe invoked different levels of design based on human intuition, and I find my religious belief and the intuition derived from my belief leads to the exact opposite conclusions. Mount Everest, to me, looks like it was designed by an infinite intelligence, and Mount Rushmore looks like it was designed in part by an infinite intelligence and then in part by a finite intelligence, using material and methods created by an infinite intelligence. Mount Everest and the natural aspects of Mount Rushmore both look to be designed at a far higher level than the carvings of faces. I think Behe's intuition and theology are completely backwards. I don't take ID seriously as a scientific project, and I'm philosophically opposed to it for core theological reasons, so I personally wouldn't engage in a debate about it. But I recommend that if Josh Swamdas is invited back, the topic be limited to the theology or philosophy of ID, not the science. Thank you very much, Paul. Good to hear from you. And we've had other responses to that show as well, but we'll leave them to one side for the moment, because I do want to get to this one. This was very interesting. You remember we did a show on conversion and deconversion with Jana Harman and Joel Furches. Both have done quite a bit of research in that area. This was from James in Swindon, who says, I started listening to your podcast about a year ago. Really enjoy the people you manage to bring together and the topics they discuss. Also appreciate the job you do moderating, which can't be the easiest thing to do. The discussion between Jana Harman and Joel Furches was of interest, especially when talking about why Christians abandon their faith. And this topic has come up a number of times, such as when Joel Steingard appeared on your show, John Steingard, that is, and including how some have reconstructed their faith sometime afterwards, but to a more progressive form of Christianity, as covered in that debate between Elisa Childers and Lisa Gunga. Well, all this has encouraged me in my goal to write a book about my experience of deconstruction and reconstruction. I was a born-again, committed Christian for 15 years until I stopped believing in my mid-30s and passionately identified as a humanist atheist for 9 years and was a member of the British Humanist Association for 1 year. However, in the summer of 2015, I came back to faith after a period of reflection and with some help from books by the Christian apologist John Lennox. Please let your listeners know that although there are stories of deconversion or deconstruction, as it's often called, sometimes involving prominent former Christians, the story doesn't necessarily have to end there. I genuinely could not see how I could possibly go back to believing in God again once it had all unravelled. And yet I did. And my faith is probably even stronger for this experience. On another, perhaps selfish note, I'd be very grateful for any advice or help in writing this book. Thanks, James. Loved to hear from you from Swindon. Hey, I'll get in touch, James. Both fascinated to hear more about your story. But, well, if I've got any advice on writing books, I'm not sure it'd be very helpful. I'm struggling to write my own one at the moment. But yeah, we'll see what we could do. Here's just a couple more emails and then we'll have to wrap it up for today's show. This is going back to the great discussion between Julian Baggini and Sky Jatani on whether Jesus was just a great moral teacher or something more. Isso gets in touch to say, love the show, really believe you're doing God's work. I enjoyed that dialogue, but I think that Julian Baggini, your atheist, misses the messianic context in which Christ is speaking and trivializes Christ's teachings. I believe Christ's teachings are literally impossible, but that's the point. You say, I was reading the Gospel of Luke a few months ago, trying to grapple with what I do with Jesus. So I wrote an article about it to explore who he actually is. Hope you get a chance to read it. Thanks for linking me to that article, by the way, Isso. Exactly who is Jesus, the Son of God? It's published over at the Medium website. So appreciate you sending that in. On that debate, Helen in North London said, Sky made a comment about the many Christians and Americans who support Donald Trump as being dumbed down and seeing the Bible as a tokenistic thing. I'm not convinced this explains it. I frequently come across this view, but would like to offer an alternative explanation. I'm not trying to make out Trump is a saint, but that he's no worse a sinner than the rest of us and has instigated, in fact, some godly policies in his 3 going on 4 years as a president. I'm rejecting the notion perpetuated in the media that he's a madman and anyone who supports him is deluded. And you go on to give about 12 or 14 reasons, in fact, about why you believe he's actually done a lot of good. Thank you very much, Helen. No time to read out all of those. But of course, the reality is millions and millions of people voted for him in the latest election. And even though he has lost that election, obviously still disputed by his team, it would be, you know, crazy to say that they're all deluded. And I certainly wouldn't say that either. I'm not personally in favour of Trump. You know, that may not be much of a secret on this show, but I fully understand and sympathise with my many friends in the US who have felt it necessary to vote for Trump. I can understand why some of them, many people would feel that way. Tim is another friend out in the US, hails from Florida, has been catching up on some shows recently and said he caught up with this Sky Gitani and Julian Baggini show and says it lived up to the reviews, as I'd put it among my all-time favourites. Not having heard of either of the guests before, I'm now avidly looking at their material. The comment I'd like to leave is that C.S. Lewis's well-known trilemma passage that you quoted really should be updated to what could be termed a quadrilemma by adding a fourth category, also beginning with an L. Lord, liar, and lunatic are not the only options, as Baggini pointed out. As an atheist, he opts for the fourth option, legend. As one can see on many a Christmas card, certain elements of legend have obviously accrued in the intervening 2,000 years. Nevertheless, relegating the miracle stories and other supernatural aspects of the New Testament accounts to mere legend, while a convenient escape hatch for those committed to naturalistic presuppositions, is not, in my opinion, being intellectually honest. While there's obviously no way to prove that the miracles of Jesus actually happened, since they were one-time events in the distant past, there's a surprising amount of circumstantial evidence, particularly when it comes to the greatest miracle of all, the resurrection of the crucified Jesus. Many a skeptic has approached that evidence with the intent of backing up that fourth option of legend, only to become believers themselves. So while on the surface the fourth option is there for our quadrilemma, in reality it actually isn't, which puts us right back to C.S. Lewis's trilemma. Either way, though, this leads to the dilemma every person faces. Either he is or he is not who he claimed to be. C.S. Lewis had it right. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much for all of those emails across a whole range of shows we've had in the past several weeks. It's been good, hasn't it? It's been really interesting to get so much interaction and engagement. And speaking of the conversion deconversion episode, which we covered, there's a great blog by our friend Eric, Eric Strandness, on our Pathos blog that's getting a lot of interest at the moment, looking at some of the lessons that you can draw from why Christians become atheists and atheists become Christians. Again, that's over at our Pathos blog. Thanks for being part of today's show. And with Giving Tuesday coming up, you can support the show as well. If you're out in the US listening via podcast, unbelievable.show is a great place to do that. And anywhere else in the world, we welcome your gifts and thank you for them at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on give. For now, thanks very much. And let me tell you what's coming up next week. Is the God of the Old Testament a capriciously malevolent, misogynistic, sadomasochistic bully? That, of course, was the famous claim alongside many other negative adjectives that Richard Dawkins gave in The God Delusion. Well, atheist Dan Barker followed it up with a book of his own in which he essentially justified or defended every single one of those objections against the God of the Bible. Recently, Martin Kurt, a vicar in the UK, has taken it upon himself to respond to all of those critiques. He'll be on the show with Dan Barker next week to debate the God of the Bible. So, thanks for being with us. See you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.